ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय
रायनाम नमस्कृत्यं नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं प्रथौजाय मुदिरये नस्ताप्रायेषु भजेषु नित्यं भगवतस्ते सेवया भागवती रामश्लोके भक्ति भगवती नैष्ठिकी
For reading from the first canto, 19th chapter, 33rd verse.
Yesham samsmara na pungsa.
Yesham samsmara na pungsa.
Yesham samsmara na pungsa.
Yesham samsmara na pungsa.
Sadhya shudyanti bhai griha.
Sadhya shudyanti bhai griha.
Sadhya shudyanti bhai griha.
In the Sanskrit language, we hear certain words repeated over and over again, and we come to know what love words mean. So, samsmaranat, by remembrance, what word do we recognize there that's common? Yeah, smaranat means remembering. And shudyanti. Shuddha means the pure. Cleanses. And vai, it's a word we hear a lot. You know what that means? Because they see it so much, certainly. Griha. Puna. Again, or then. And darshana. Very common word, we know that. Means to have an audience or meeting. Sparsha. Touch. And para. Means feet. And shocha. It's pure cleansing. And asana. So Prabhupada's translation of this text is, simply by our remembering you, our house becomes instantly sanctified. And what to speak of seeing you, touching you, washing your holy feet, and offering you a seat in our home responsibly. Simply by our remembering you.
Simply by our remembering you.
Our houses become instantly sanctified.
Our houses become instantly sanctified.
And what to speak of seeing you.
And what to speak of seeing you.
Touching you.
Touching you.
Washing your holy feet.
Washing your holy feet.
And offering you a seat in our home.
And offering you a seat in our home.
Purport Vaishnava Prabhupada. The importance of holy places of pilgrimage is due to the presence of great sages and saints. It is said that sinful persons go to the holy places to leave their sins there to accumulate. But the presence of the great saints disinfects the accumulated sins, and thus the holy places continue to remain sanctified by the grace of the devotees and the saints present there. If such saints appear in the homes of worldly people, certainly the accumulated sins of such worldly enjoyers becomes neutralized. Therefore, the holy saints actually have no interest with the householders. The only aim of such saints is to sanctify the houses of the householders, and the householders therefore should feel grateful when such saints and sages appear at their doors. A householder who dishonors such holy orders is a great offender. It is enjoined, therefore, that a householder who does not bow down before a saint then one must undergo fasting for the day in order to neutralize the great offense.
Om Gyanatimirandasya Gananjana Sarakaya
Chaksura Paitam Jena Tatmai Shigurvayamah
Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam
Jena Bhutale
Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dhrati
Svadandhika. Prabhupada is speaking of saints, sometimes referred to as sadhus, Sanskrit, sadhu eva samantavya. Even if one, it is said in the 9th chapter, 30th verse of Bhagavad Gita, performs the most abominable activities, if such a person reforms and renders pure devotional service, then that person is to be considered sadhu, or saint, sainted person. In the Christian tradition, there is the three-part process of prayaschitta, of confession, contrition, and redemption. That is, one has to feel that it was wrong, reveal everything about it, confess, and or feel guilty. Confession, first of all, to see that it is wrong, and to confess, to feel that it is wrong, and then to do something to rectify, to redeem. And that redemption is more than just saying, there are certain types of things you can do that are prescribed in the shastras to overcome sinful activities. Certain types of penances or austerities, certain activities, they're named for overcoming various types of sin that are also named. However, this type of priyaschita is not particularly recommended by Srila Prabhupada, especially in the story of King Nriga. Prabhupada comments in the Krishna book that even though King Nriga underwent a certain type of priyaschita, still the desire to again enjoy or to commit sinful activity remained. Therefore, whatever we do to counteract such sinful activity is not pure and perfect, because the desire to again enjoy or the desire to commit sinful activity remains within the heart. And therefore, atonement is not necessarily the mark of overcoming sinful desire or becoming pure. When I was in the Los Angeles temple, we visited a Catholic school. Mother Mary of the Sea was called nearby. And after the class, which was very well attended, many of the sisters came in to hear our class, and some students from adjoining classes came in to join it. They were very attentive and asked very good questions. The young priest took us into his chambers and had a discussion with us. He was very interested in Krishna consciousness. And he told us many things, kind of personal things. And one of the things he was quick to admit was that he felt very unhappy that weekend after weekend, the same young people would come into his confession box and confess the same sins over and over again. That they had been drinking, they had been philandering or going out with girls and taking various other forms of intoxication and partying very wildly. And they were very sorry about it. But they continued to come back weekend after weekend to confess the very same sins. So he was lamenting that this was very unhappy, very unfortunate. He had to hear the same people saying the same thing weekend after weekend. That even though they were sorry, they felt bad about it, and they would say, Hail Mary, Mother of God, or whatever, to counteract the sin, to confess to their priest, that's a kind of form of redemption. They still continued to do it because the desire wasn't eradicated from the heart. So Bhagavad Gita calls such persons pretenders. That if we don't engage in pure devotional service, the desire remains in the heart to commit sinful activities. When one engages in pure devotional service, all desire is eradicated from the heart. and one becomes pure. And one's only desire becomes satisfied by the senses of Krishna, not one's own senses. So devotional service is unique in that way. Lord Brahma states that one who engages in pure devotional service eradicates all karma. Karmani nirdahati kintu chabakti bhajam. We have so many desires. The human being can accommodate literally hundreds, if not thousands and millions of desires within the mind. But one who engages in personal service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who tries to please the senses of Krishna, actually eradicates, cleanses, erases all those desires that are constantly there in the mind and in the heart of the living being. Just by seeing, hearing, touching, and smelling something material, we become attracted. By just thinking of anything enjoyable, we become attracted. It is also said by Rupa Goswami that one who engages in devotional service can eradicate more sins than can be committed. Your devotional service is so special, so extraordinary, so unique, that it immediately cleanses the heart and the mind of all desire, even desire for sinful activity. In Kali Yuga, it is stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam that one actually has to perform sinful activities before they are considered sinful or that one should be punished. Whereas in other yugas, one simply has to think of a sinful activity and it becomes sinful. So in the age of Kali, we're given many special dispensations, many concessions. We can just chant Hare Krishna and go back to Godhead. If we think sinful activity, but don't commit them, we can be saved. But devotional service is so pure and so purifying that even it cleanses the mind from thinking about sinful activities. Of course, this doesn't happen overnight. It's a very gradual process. But the mind does become purified. The heart does become purified. And gradually we enter into the pure, purified state. Mamshayo bhyabhicharine bhakti yogena sevate, in which there is no returning to the material world. You want to come to that stage. That is the stage known as samadhi, or perfection, which is described in the first chapter, first verse of the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Without doubt, we are fixed in the devotional service of Krishna. This is the aim of a devotee. This is what we mean when we encounter the word sadhu, or saintly. We have little or no experience of a saintly person in this material world. In fact, as soon as we think of person, we think of conditions. We think of elevation and depression. We think of imperfection. We think of all kinds of difficulties, personal, societal, that are encountered. So to think of a person as saintly is very, very difficult. Because we know that people are fraught with difficulties. The very word person means that there are difficulties, that there are conditions, that there are imperfections. Last night I visited the loft and had the opportunity to hear Devamrita Maharaj speaking. And part of his class was talking about the difference between impersonalism and personalism. And the group was admitting, at his prompting, that we are very afraid to think of any person as being pure or perfect. Of course, he was talking about the Supreme Lord, Krishna. But we are very afraid to think of God as being a person. Maybe when we're very young, especially. It's not so much of a problem. We can sort of pray to God. We're taught that way. And people, I think, when they're in distress, they pray. Of course, if you're praying, then that means that you expect that someone's going to be hearing that. And people generally, apart from when they're young, it requires a great bit of desperation for someone to start actually praying to some person or some entity, some force that they can't see. There was a cartoon someone pointed out to me of a middle-aged man kneeling by the side of his bed in supplication, that kind of a posture. And he was saying, God, please let me get through these accusations of embezzlement and sleaze. It was probably meant to have been some politician who was being accused of some very underhanded activity. And he was, his reputation or his position was at risk, so he was praying to God. Obviously a very degraded person, but in a very desperate situation, he was speaking to something he couldn't see. And when we're little children, sometimes we do that, don't we? We pray to God. I remember when I was very young, I used to, because I was taught that you could pray, but my prayer was just that my mommy and daddy should be okay, nothing should go wrong, everything should be alright. Because we're taught that God will make everything okay. That he's the only person who can make everything alright. So in this class yesterday at the law, the idea was being put forward that we don't like to think of God as a person, because we don't have any experience of people that are completely pure and perfect. They're all imperfect. They're all conditioned. So it's very, very difficult to think of Krishna as a person. Very difficult. Anyone who attained a certain age, even though there might be prayer, and there might be some idea of that, there's someone watching over me, there's a supreme entity, to think of that entity as a person, very, very, very difficult. But Krishna asserts this in Bhagavad Gita. And not only asserts that he is a person, but he asserts that there are representatives of himself. People who are, by being very attached to him, are very pure. When I think it's on one of the new CDs that's been released by the DBT, there's a conversation where Prabhupada was talking with John Lennon and George Harrison and Yoko Ono. And they were asking him, how does one know who is pure? Because after all, everyone is saying, I'm it, I'm the guru, I'm in charge, I know what's right, and I'm the spiritual master. And we know that for every genuine spiritual person, there's probably thousands of counterfeits. So Prabhupada's answer, very surprisingly, was, anyone know? Did you hear that tape?
The person who's most addicted to
Krishna. Yeah, he said the person who's most addicted to Krishna. That's a very kind of negative thing in a way, because when we think of addictions, we think of being addicted to things that are not very good for us, abusive substances and so forth. But when we're actually addicted to God, to Krishna, that is not only okay, but it's what makes the difference between a person who is saintly and a real, genuine spiritual person and one who is a fraud, one who is not saintly, one who is just trying to make money or to gain name and fame, which is what most are trying to do. So Prabhupada's answer was, you have to find a person who is sold out to Krishna, who has no other interest than serving the senses of Krishna, than serving Krishna's pleasure, knowing who Krishna is, and wanting to please that personality, because that personality has no material impropriety. That personality is not in touch with material nature. So if someone is addicted to that person, then such a person must be pure and saintly. When Maharaj Parikshit is glorifying Shukadeva Goswami as saintly, he's putting him in the category of being a completely different person, not an ordinary person, but a person who is not of this world, we might say. Not of this world. Sometimes we have an English expression, it's out of this world. Yes, out of this world. It's really good. It's out of this world. Somehow that has come to us, or maybe down to us, I don't know, but this expression that everything in this world is temporary, it's imperfect, it's misperceived sometimes, it's very conditional, it's not perfect, for sure, but if something is out of this world, or more specifically, of the spiritual world, then it can be considered pure and perfect. It was not in touch with this material world. The nature, the definition of spirit, of the spiritual world, is that, and of Krishna, who is the Supreme Spirit, is that there is no touch with this material world. There is no imperfection. So if one is completely addicted to such a person, then one can become, can be considered to be saintly, sadhu, or perfect. So we have no experience not only of God, but we have no experience of saints. We have no experience of saints. Every person is suspect. We must question authority. We're trained that way. When I was in school, it was considered very, very unfashionable to make what we call, what they called, a value judgment. You didn't make value judgments. You gathered up all the evidence on both sides, and then you made a very closely argued, very studied opinion, a very narrow opinion, because you had the evidence presented on both sides. But you couldn't start out, this is in the United States, it's still fashionable in many universities, not to make very big, very sweeping value judgments about things. You have to be scientific. You have to compile all the evidence on all sides and then see if you can come to a conclusion. That's the method that's very popular now. So to value a person as being extraordinary and not question them is not considered to be very fashionable, very intellectual. Of course, Prabhupada didn't want us to be blind followers. He wanted us to use our complete minds and intellect. But to consider, as Maharaj Parikit is doing here, that just by touching someone, just by thinking of someone, that their whole house could be purified. Just by those insignificant things, by letting someone into your home, your whole home could be purified. Washing the feet. Who would wash somebody's feet? It's a very grotesque thing to most people. It's a symbol, it's a sign of obsequiousness, of giving in to someone, of making someone your... Having a guru, to most people, is a very unpopular thing. It's a very frightening prospect to have a guru, to just surrender to someone, to do whatever they might ask. And yet such people who are saints can be surrendered to because they have no personal life. They have no interest other than the interest of the good of everyone. Prabhupada exhibited these qualities. Once he was asked, what do you think of the situation of the world? And Prabhupada said, when I think of the situation of the world, I cry. So he was questioned, well, what do you mean? Sometimes you just feel bad and cry inside. You feel just kind of bad. You feel sorry for people. And Prabhupada said, no, I actually cry. I actually cry. So this is the condition of a Vaishnava. It's Paraduka Dukhi. Feels the condition as personally very depressing, the condition of society, and wanting to help. Therefore, there is a great impetus in preaching to make people better, to make the world better, and to purify existence. So Shukadeva Goswami was a very pure personality who would associate with others only to lift them up, to elevate them, to enlighten them. He's mentioned elsewhere in the Bhagavatam as a person who had no other interest other than elevating the householders and in his sojourns of visiting. Let's see if I can find this text. These are some descriptions of Sukadeva Goswami. How did it so happen, this is text number 7, the fourth chapter of this canto, how did it so happen that King Parikit met this great sage, making it possible for this great transcendental essence of the Vedas, Bhagavatam, to be sung to him? And Prabhupada says in the first part, Srimad Bhagavatam is stated here as the essence of the Vedas. It is not an imaginary story, as it is sometimes considered by unauthorized men. It is called Shuka Samhita, the Song of Shuka, right? Or the Vedic hymn spoken by Sri Shukadeva Goswami, the great liberated sage. And then Prabhupada goes on, translates the 8th text, Sarvodohana Matramhi, Yuhayju Grihamedina, Adikshate Mahabharas Tirita Kurvam Tadashram Tadashram. He, Shukadeva Goswami, was accustomed to stay at the door of the householder only long enough for a cow to be milked. And he did this just to sanctify the residents. And Prabhupada writes in his purport, Shukadeva Goswami met Emperor Parikshit and explained the text of Srimad Bhagavatam. He was not accustomed to stay at any householder's residence for more than half an hour at the time of milking the cow, and he would just take alms from the fortunate householder. That was to sanctify the residence of his auspicious presence. Therefore, Shukadeva Goswami is an ideal preacher established in the transcendental position. From his activities, those that are in the renounced order of life and dedicated to the mission of preaching the message of Godhead should learn that they have no business with householders save and except to enlighten them in transcendental knowledge. Such asking for alms from the householder should be for the purpose of sanctifying his home. One who is in the renounced order of life should not be allured by the glamour of the householder's worldly possessions and thus become subservient to worldly men. For one who is in the renounced order of life, this is much more dangerous than drinking poison or committing suicide. Very powerful words from Srila Prabhupada. Very powerful. More dangerous than drinking poison or committing suicide is to be allured by Maya, to be enamored by wealth, beauty, fame, education, aristocracy. Very subtle and very easy to be enamored by such things. And sometimes we encounter such things in our preaching. We have to build a beautiful temple for Krishna. We have to approach worldly people sometimes. And we've seen that sometimes devotees who are fixed up, we think, become enamored by those things. And then they gradually become absorbed in thinking about such things. And they gradually become attracted to such things. And they gradually lose their fixed up determination to be Krishna conscious. It is stated in the Bhagavad Gita that it is very difficult to have a single-minded attention. If one is attracted to the glitter of material nature, if one enters into these environments and becomes enwrapped with them, instead of trying to utilize them in the service of Krishna, one becomes bewildered, which is the word used here, and ceases to be determined, the other side, mika buddhir, samadho navidiyate, then resolute determination to engage in devotional service cannot take place. It does not enter into the heart, or it disintegrates, actually. So, in one sense, bhakti yoga is kind of like a tightrope. It's a walking a very fine razor's edge. We're taking a great risk in being devotees because we have to preach. And in the course of the preaching, we may be bewildered by so many things. Therefore, Prabhupada has given us preaching and our internal spiritual development to be living in the spiritual atmosphere, to come before the deities, and to constantly read, to constantly chant, to constantly renew and refresh our Krishna consciousness so that we don't become victims of Maya. Even though we have to associate intimately sometimes with Maya. It's not actually that we should associate intimately, but we should reserve our intimacy for devotees. And we can become friends, and we can see others as innocent, but for the preaching process, we have to sometimes be very tactful, just like Prabhupada was, very diplomatic, and speak according to the circumstances. Still, we have to be very fixed in our determination. The other side, our determination will be very fixed in Krishna consciousness. Engage in washing the feet and feeding and treating the great saints very nicely. When Prabhupada was writing the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, in one of his purports, he mentions that in his father's house, there were always guests. And he talked about one sannyasi, not in that book, but in the lecture, who would come to his house. And he said that he always carried himself as a gopi. And there was another saint who came to their house who had perfected the perfection of the siddhi of a prati. He could acquire things. And Prabhupada mentions that he produced a pomegranate that he got from Afghanistan just by reaching for it. So, in his father's house, there are so many wonderful saints. And in one sense, the system of hospitality is there because we don't know who these saints, who anybody might be. They might be saints in disguise. And we have the story of King Runti Dev from the 9th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. King Runti Dev was fasting. He fasted for 48 days as an austerity. And he was just about ready to eat when a Brahmin came to the door. And he could not refuse the Brahmin. And he said, "Oh, my dear Brahmin, please take some food." It is also mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, one of Prabhupada's purports, when the Kumaras go to visit the Lord Vishnu, that one should always offer not only food to a visitor, any kind of visitor, what to speak of a saint, but should offer a nice eating place, nice water, nice words, and a resting place if possible. And Prabhupada goes on to say, if you don't have the food, you can at least offer the guest water. And if you don't have water, at least offer the guest a nice place to sit. And if you don't even have a nice place to sit, at least speak very nicely, very sweetly. If you're happy, you speak with tears in your eyes and beg the saint, or beg the visitor to forgive you for not being able to accommodate him nicely. So King Runti Dev offered the Brahmin lots of foodstuffs. And then he was just ready to eat again when a sutra appeared at the door. And he said, I'm very hungry. Can you please spare something to eat? So King Runti Dev, again, who had been fasting and only had half of what he was going to eat left, offered everything to the sutra. And he had nothing left. He was fasting for 48 days. And he offered the sutra the rest because he was a very hungry man. After the sugar came, Runti Dev then prepared to take some water because he could break his fast. When another guest appeared, and this guest was carrying dogs with it, was surrounded by dogs, and said, "Please give me something to drink. I'm so thirsty. I'm on the brink. I have to have something to drink." So Lord Runti Dev, King Runti Dev, gave him some of his water. He was described in the Bhagavatam as being on the brink of death. King Runti Dev, he was that emaciated for not eating or drinking, and yet he gave the remaining water to his guest. Shortly thereafter, when King Runti Dev, through this process, became free from thirst and hunger for the rest of his life. He never experienced thirst and hunger because of this act of charity. But shortly thereafter, the demigods appeared to him, like Lord Rama and Lord Shiva, and they said that they had disguised themselves. They had presented themselves as the Brahmin and the Shudra and the dog eater, and that they were very, very happy to confer their blessings upon him for being such a surrendered soul. So this guest is sometimes we mention called Atithi Narayan, is the unwanted or the unannounced guest who appears in the house, in the home. At the door of the household. So Prabhupada remembers the system that people used to go out, the householders on the front of their house, and call out before they leave, "Is there anyone hungry who will join me?" So they're always that charitable, that kind of mind, that is the Vedic hospitality. So a saint or a saintly person is very extraordinary, but anyone who comes should be honored very nicely by the Vaishnavas. It's the nature of the age to not want to be bothered. Everybody is living in a very isolated way. When I was 16, I traveled from Portland, Oregon to Los Angeles. It was my first journey to Los Angeles to see my friends. I have a friend who lived down there. And they had a nice house with a swimming pool. And in Van Nuys, California, I noticed that even though the standard of living was very high down there, that's why they moved down to Los Angeles, that they didn't even know their next-door neighbors. They didn't know their names, and their next-door neighbors didn't know their names. And everyone lived a very insular, isolated kind of existence. It was like that all over Los Angeles. And, of course, it's like that in Beverly Hills. It's like that in Potomac, where we have our temple. The neighbors don't know each other, really. And they're very affluent. Their houses are worth millions of dollars each. And recently I was saying in Amitapani's gathering the other night that a report was done, a very systematic scientific report in England, that found out which countries had the happiest people. So which country do you think they found the happiest people in? Guess. India. Any other guesses? One other guess. You already know his answer. One other guess. The happiest people in the world are in what country?
Africa.
Africa, India, Fiji? Well, India was the closest because it's Bangladesh. And according to that study, and Bangladesh is considered to be, if not the poorest, definitely one of the poorest, poorest India countries of the world. And yet people are happy. And the United States, where would you say it ranked? Say there's, I don't know, 150 or so countries. It was down there. It was in the 50s or 40s. And people think that this is the land of milk and honey. This is the place where people have the most money. So naturally, they're going to be the happiest because they have the best houses and cars and airplanes and enjoyments and computers and vacations and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was fun. Really, it's understanding that from within, we're happy. And what we're really happy doing is when we're with people, when we're, of course, speaking about Krishna, and not isolated from our neighbors. When we have an open door, we have open hearts, we want to share our meals and our minds with people. We have the greatest thing to share. We have Krishna consciousness to share with people. And there is nothing more satisfying, right? Nothing more happy than to speak about Krishna directly or indirectly with others. So we get inspiration from people like Shukadeva Goswami, the speaker of the Bhagavatam. We get inspiration from being with such personalities. We get purified by them. And if we associate with them, we become saintly ourselves. Eventually, gradually, we attain those qualities. And we become very happy. So it's the prerogative, or I should say, the duty, the obligation of all of us to associate with those we consider spiritually advanced more than we are, whenever we can, as much as we can, because we get purified and we get first-hand knowledge of the personality of Godhead. We get a sense, we get a semblance of what the pure, supreme, perfect is like, associating with saints, those who are addicted, hopelessly addicted, to Shiva, to God, to Krishna, to Sri Krishna, or even to Prabhupada, I suppose we can say. Prabhupada is certainly Nityasiddha, pure devotee. So we'll end there today. I'll read the verse again if we have some questions and comments. Yesham sasmaranatam sam sadhya shugyanti vairiha kim punardarshana sparsha apara socha sanadivi. Simply by our remembering you, our houses become instantly sanctified. And we'll also speak of seeing you, touching you, washing your holy feet and offering you a seat in our home. So, some comments or questions?
What made the people in Bangladesh happier than the people in America?
I don't know. I mean, we can speculate.
Didn't include that in the study?
No. But it was mentioned that, I think, that they were religious. That they had God at the center of their lives. And, I mean, I don't know how accurate that survey was. Maybe it's more accurate to say people in India are more happy. I think India was third or fourth, something like that. But that's the idea. That, if we're happy with Him, if we actually feel the presence of God within, we're happy. Yes?
Maharaj,
actually much more people that bring you to the cultural surface that takes away all of our desires. Because there also take away the roots and the seed of those desires.
It's yes, because pure devotional service eradicates karma. Yes, tumba gopa mata bindra mahusva karma bandana rupa mata paramatma tanopanati karmati nirdhati kinshu chabakti bhajam. That verse says that if one worships the Supreme Personality of God, it's from Brahma Samhita, that our karma becomes eradicated. Karma is the seed, it's the desire. When we say we have we're accumulating karma, good karma, we're eradicating the seeds of desire. And until those seeds are actually eradicated, we don't lose the impetus to do simple activities. Rupa Goswami speaks of these in terms of seeds, the unsprouted seeds of desire, bija, seeds, and the sprouted seeds. And he says that in order to remount the heart and mind of all the seeds of simple desire, we actually have to render those seeds impotent. We have to fry them. I don't know if he uses the word fry, or bake, or cook, or something like that. And then, if you do that to seeds, they won't sprout because they lose their potency. So we have to do that. We have to confront those desires in the heart, those seeds of simple desire, and cook them so that they are no longer possible to sprout and surround the devotional creeper like a weed and consume it. Sometimes you see these trees that have a big vine going around them, and eventually they get eaten by the other tree that surrounds them. So our devotional creeper is like that. It's very delicate, and it can be victimized. It can succumb to these other weed-like desires in the heart. But one who engages in devotional service, all of the seeds of karma, devotional service is so powerful that it is the incinerator of all these seeds of simple desire. It stops them cold. So if we continue to engage in devotional service, we may slip and fall sometime on the slippery slope of devotional service, but if we get up and we continue, Krishna will help us. Krishna is always pulling us towards Him with the rope of love, even though sometimes we, like little children, are starting to walk or falling down, but we keep getting up and trying, and Krishna will help us, just like the father is taking the hand of the little child and helping him or her to walk. Yes.
Also, this query about the parabdha, that's what you're talking about in a sense, but is it for the devotees that we have to experience that parabdha on devotional service virtually purifies us? But I understand we don't make any more parabdha, but we still have to go through our individual parabdha, yeah. or is that
individual? Process? What's the word you're using?
Parabdha. It's a fact.
I'm sorry. Yes. We have to engage constantly in pure devotional service. That is the imperative of the devotee. Whether we are going to overcome everything right away or not is generally we don't. It takes time. And therefore we have to act according to what we sometimes call sub-religious principles. We have to act in a way that's maybe you can give me a specific example and I can answer your question better.
Okay, well it seems to me that another thing connected to that is that I'd always hope the spiritual master takes your karma into consideration. But if we all have an individual parabdha to execute, then that doesn't seem to affect. He obviously takes the percentage, but it's someone else. So in devotional service, you see some people, they break a leg, some people have an accident, other people are, you know, that we're all subject still to individual karma, so we're still experiencing that. But it's not that as soon as you perform, because we're performing mixed devotional service, that's automatically removed, which is what a lot of devotees say.
There's a very nice explanation of this in the Tenth Canto. It's actually an explanation by Vridhananda Maharaj and company, who were writing purports. And in the purport to the verse, which says that if one, even while earnestly awaiting the Lord's causeless mercy, experiences difficulty, patiently awaits the patient that suffers the results of past wrongdoing, and bows to the Lord with body, mind, and words. One is then eligible for liberation because it becomes right plain. Prabhupada puts that also on the Bhagavad Gita, that verse. So a very nice explanation there in the purports, that while we apparently suffer karmic reactions, it's not exactly the same as karma, because the Lord is taking charge of the devotee. Therefore, sometimes we break a leg, or we lose our wealth, or we lose our situation. That is yasyaham anugranami hariche tadanamshinai. That is Krishna bringing us closer to Him by taking things away from us. And as He says, in answer to that question by the Maharaj Parikit to Shukadeva, Shukadeva answers his question. He tells the story of Vikasara, who got the benediction to shatter the head of anyone he touched, but he didn't use it properly. He wanted to kill Lord Shiva. He got the benediction for Lord Shiva, and he tried to kill Lord Shiva. And Lord Vishnu had to save him. Lord Narayana had to save him. So when he was answering that question, he was showing that if we have benedictions, if we have a lot of good blessings, so we probably won't use them in the right way. And therefore Krishna says, Anugraham, I will sometimes, as the first installment of my mercy, take things away from my devotee. That is Krishna's mercy. It's not exactly karma. And Prabhupada also describes that we sometimes have our it's like a fan. You know, we pull the plug out of the fan, but it continues. So there is some residual karma left, even when we begin devotional service. But it's not the same. Not the same as the fan being plugged in. We're gradually winding down our karma. So it may appear that we're experiencing some bad fortune, some bad karma, but actually it is the Lord bringing us closer to Him. It's what it actually is. And it's the or it's some residual karma that we have. So in the 10th canto, it is stated that Petuno Kampam Susimishwana, that we have to see that maybe it's karma, maybe it's residual karma, maybe it's Krishna bringing us closer to Him, but we still offer our respects to Krishna. And we shouldn't think that it's all being taken by someone else, so that we don't have to do anything, we don't have to do devotional service, because I got initiated, therefore it's over, and my spiritual master has to take on karma, so I'm not going to have any bad karma. Actually, although Prabhupada has said that many times, the purity through which, it's actually Krishna who destroys the karma, because He's the all-purifying agent. So if the spiritual master is transparent and taking us on, even though it is said the spiritual master has to come back to this material world until the disciples are all purified, still it is, as a transparent medium, the spiritual master is acting on behalf of Krishna. Krishna takes that and purifies that karma. So it's not that the spiritual master has to suffer, you know, all of the things that constantly are going on with all the sinful activities of disciples or fallen disciples. But it's Krishna that's actually. Otherwise, we can understand that Srila Prabhupada had thousands of disciples, and there were hundreds and hundreds who fell down and committed all sorts of abominable activity during Prabhupada's life, but Prabhupada just went on and on and on preaching. So we don't consider that he was suffering all that time. But a devotee who is very compassionate, even not a spiritual master, wants to, like Vasudeva, he wanted to take the karma of everyone, and he was glorified by Lord Chaitanya. So what do you do? Sometimes we have to suffer, but we see that that's the mercy of Krishna. Not just karma. It may be karma, it may not be, but gradually that karma is eradicated. Does that help?
Yes. If someone falls down, and it seems that they were a very good devotee, could it be due to sinful reactions from a long, long time ago?
Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada talks about how a weaker devotee is overcome by Maya, and then the fall down is accidental. And that could be in the form of some past activity, some very remote past thing. Who was it that was brought before Yamaraj for piercing an insect in a previous life?
Mundaka.
Huh?
Mundaka Muni.
Mundaka Muni, yes. So we can say that he was a victim. And in a sense he was, because he was victim of violent Nakamuni, and he was spared by Maharaj for that punishment. But there was some little bit of punishment. So Prabhupada talks about sometimes the token punishments that he got. He said he was in a train and there was a big crash and people died, but he just switched seats, so to speak. And he carried himself as being, that was maybe due to some simple activity in the past. So it's possible. The law of karma is inscrutable. We don't know why exactly we're here in devotional service. We may have committed some simple activity. But we have to suffer those things according to the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. We may have to suffer due to some past activity. But at the same time, I continue and I bow to Krishna and I offer my words of praise to him. Yes.
But if someone gives up Krishna consciousness, can they blame, you know, like previous reactions for it? I mean, it seems a way of absolving responsibility in the...
Well, if I blame previous activity, I can only blame myself. Mm-hmm. So that's okay. Because it is a result of my desire that I did that thing. And I'm not blaming Krishna, but some people do. I'm not blaming other people. I'm not blaming Maya, but I'm blaming myself for being weak, for succumbing to those desires. So ultimately we're responsible for our own lives. And we have to take that responsibility. We're given a free will by the Lord, by the spiritual master, to enact that free will. So we can either act simply, or we can act according to the liberating principles of freedom, the regulated principles of freedom. We have that choice. We always have that choice. Yeah?
As far as meeting tribulations as a special mercy from the Lord, the Christians also seem to have this understanding. So, would you say this is the general principle?
One can make. Did you ever hear his question? He said that people that aren't. That he talked to Christians also see that the mercy of the Lord is always there. And is that your question? Was that a principle that we?
That's referring to bringing given to me by God so that to become a teacher from among God, so that many Christians can also speak like this.
So we can take shelter because we're getting mercy. The difference is that those who are outside of the Vedic tradition tend to make religion or God very cheap. And they think that although Bhagavad Gita says we can forgive someone who comes to the right path, there is a notion that a person has to be forgiven immediately for whatever they do, even though they may not feel they did something wrong. That is a cheapening kind of religion. And of course, people outside the Vedic tradition are also committing all sorts of seva aparadhas, but to speak of non-aparadhas, eating meat, taking intoxication, having illicit sex and gambling, and thinking God's mercy is always on me, or I will go to heaven when I die. That is a very cheap way to think of God as spirituality. It's not the real thing, because it is full of aparadhas, full of different kinds of aparadhas. So one can say, I love God, or God's mercy is all upon me, or I'm doing things for the God or the church or whatever. But because of so many aparadhas, that kind of activity will not be effective, will not be helpful. In fact, it can be very hypocritical. I mean, it's good if it leads one to become purified, but to justify sinful acts in terms of loving God, or that I can go to confession and it's all wiped away, that's not part of what the great sages and saints recommend for Vaishnavas.
As you're talking about receiving guests and that people don't know their neighbours anymore. Mm. So what would you say is the cause, or some of the causes why people are so kind of insulated from each other these days? There's not so much of a community spirit.
Because they're very enamoured with Maya, and they think that their own, within the confines of their own home, that they have everything they want. They have television, they have their internet surfing. They have their games, they have their swimming pools, they have their telephones. And after work, there's not much to do but eat, have sex, and go to bed, and sleep. So who has time to know the neighbors, to spend time with them? This is Maya. Maya is acting on us to make us think that everything gravitates around me and my immediate family and my job and whatever toys I have to play with. And therefore, having a sense of community is a far, far lesser important thing and insignificant and actually irrelevant thing. Before there was so much technology, the church was the center of life and people knew their neighbors and they spent time with them and they talked with them and they worshiped together. I think we have time for one more question.
Maharaj, you mentioned that people come to temples to get rid of sinful reactions. So would that mean that anybody living in a temple is in a dangerous position because they're taking on all these sinful reactions?
Well, the verse, what Prabhupada said was that he was referring to all the places of pilgrimage. Well, in fact, the temple. Although temples are places of pilgrimage. But Prabhupada was referring specifically to the places of pilgrimage. But he said, actually, that they get purified by the saints that come there, saints and sages. The places of pilgrimage, like in Puri or in Dwarka or Tirupati, are filled with people who come there to get benedictions. They're seen to be putting their gold watches and rings and transistor radios and even laptop computers in the hundi box because they want to get something. They want to achieve something better. And in that sense, they're kind of leaving all their sinful activities. Many of them are very, very simple, and they think that by leaving a few gold rings in the hundi box, they're going to get absolved. But they're constantly coming there, and they're contaminating the holy places. So in a sense, they become like toxic waste dumps of the consciousness. But Prabhupada went to Tirupati, and to Dwarka, and many other places. And Prabhupada's followers, who set their holy feet on the dhams, are engaged in pure devotional service, so they're purifying the dham. So, what is pure? It can also mean those who are in following the pure. Prabhupada gave the example of the engineer who's making the drawings, but the architect or the planner, he has the complete picture, so he's designed it. But the person who's making the drawings or pouring cement is equal to the architect in that sense that he's doing the same work exactly because he's following exactly the drawing, the requirement. So one who follows the pure, and these temples are all erected in the wake of Srila Prabhupada, are following him very much as an engineer, or I should say a draftsman follows the plan of the engineer or the architect. Therefore, they temples are getting constantly purified and re-purified. So instead of being dangerous, they're actually the safest places to live because they're the purest places because Prabhupada and his followers and the deities and the books and the prasadam and the chanting are constantly here. So the whole atmosphere is very purifying. So we'll stop there and Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.